pleasures of coming to Irvington, of course, is the opportunity to go down into Manhattan. It's an absolutely fascinating city to explore. It's always fun for me to come up to Yoffie and kind of get out of Washington. Now, Washington's a very incestuous place. You know, it's certainly, if you live in another country, your capital city probably operates in much the same way. I mean, my guess would be the Brazilian government. Not sure I would want to spend a lot of time in the government precincts there or, you know, almost anywhere else. But Washington, you know, I joke that the Washington Post is kind of the company newsletter. You know, I mean, who's up, who's down. You know, the issues that are very important, you know, when a new administration comes in is not how do you save the U.S. economy. It's a question of who gets the big corner office that Henry Kissinger once had. Because symbolically, that tells the world you're important. You know, you want to get on the president's calendar. There are ways that capital cities operate, there are ways that Washington operates. You know, and you know, it's a fascinating place, but it's a very frustrating place if you believe in human liberty, because, of course, Washington doesn't concern itself an awful lot with human liberty. It's concerned about an awful lot of other things. You know, and the question is, How do you create a free society? How does one, you know, use politics? How does one use law? What are the goals, you know, that we should have to try to create a free society? I think it's worth, you know, recognizing that in many ways the question of a free society is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, throughout most of human history, you know, we didn't see many free societies. You know, you go back, you know, kind of, you know, studying world civilizations and ancient history is very interesting, but what you typically don't have is a lot of human liberty. You have lots of armies rampaging around the world and empires being built and massive buildings being built by slave labor and one empire conquering yet another empire, and it's the great and glorious Xerxes or the great and glorious Darius or the great and glorious Nebuchadnezzar, you know, but nobody really cares very much about people on the bottom. And that's, you know, for the most part, you know, you had empires, you had rule of men, you had a question, it was simply a question of power. You know, these were not law-based societies. These were not systems where anybody asked, is this a proper role of government? You know, you didn't have, you know, kind of notions of separations of responsibilities. You know, this is a world that the only thing that really mattered was power. And there was, you know, there were kind of limited moments, glimpses that, you know, one could argue for the future. One thinks, you know, of the Greek city-states. One could think of the early Roman Republic, which, you know, certainly were not liberal societies in our sense. But they did have at least some senses of limitations and order. I mean, what you had a very limited franchise. You typically didn't have much sense of a limits on the state in terms of what state power could do. Nevertheless, if you compared them to the world around them, compare the Greek city-states to the Persian Empire, for example, there were fairly significant differences in terms of the notion of, there is a notion of citizenship that existed, a notion of responsibility, a notion of, you know, at least some level of rights that a few members of society had. You know, so you had there, I think, an element that was important in terms of what we see in human liberty today. They didn't last very long, of course. They were ultimately, you know, kind of swallowed up by succeeding empires. The Roman Republic became the Roman Empire and, you know, ended up swallowing most everything within its region. And, you know, after that, you know, there were a wide variety of systems. I mean, there were tribal systems, there's Byzantium, there's, you know, Islamic systems, there's medieval, you know, kingdoms, you know, there's Reformation cities. I mean, what you had is a fairly wide succession of political entities that exist over time. And again, you know, there were moments where you could look. I mean, some of the German tribes had, if not exactly democratic systems, had some sense of, you know, they weren't really totalitarian in the sense that we would be thinking of. Some of the Italian city-states early on had varying forms of at least limitations, franchises, and whatnot. Nevertheless, for the most part, you know, this is a very unfree world. This is not a world that we would view, you know, kind of human liberty as being very relevant. And I think, you know, you really see, in, from our standpoint, the important changes in many ways, I think, coming around the 16th century. Where two different phenomena are occurring that I think as they come together are very important for us. The first is the Reformation, which is not a question in terms of theology. I'm not particularly interested in arguing about Protestantism versus Catholicism, but the notion that you're seeing a breakup within kind of the monopoly church and the struggles then that it has with political authorities. And in the middle of the 1500s, you see typically the Netherlands trying to break away from the Habsburg Empire. Spain in particular. So what you're seeing going on there is a breakaway attempt against a fairly authoritarian monarchy to what became much more democratic in its political orientation. So you've then got two trends going on. You've got kind of a struggle between religion and state, So you're breaking up power between these different entities, and you're also getting a struggle within the state in terms of relative responsibilities. You know, are there limits on a monarch? Or what is the role of a legislature or a parliament? These sorts of things. So both of these trends, you know, I think are very, very important. And we see both of them play a very important role in Great Britain. You know, Henry VIII, you know, wants to get a divorce. He can't get it. The Pope won't give it. So he, oh, that's it. Throws out the Catholic Church. Now we're going to have my own church, the Anglican Church. You know, so you're seeing there the culmination of this kind of religious struggle. And then you see over a long period of time the struggle between Parliament and the King. You know, where you have an evolution. You move from a very authoritarian monarch to one who's limited. You want money, you got to go to Parliament. You know, and I mean, the king could kind of, you know, appoint people and use money to try to buy votes and a number of things. Nevertheless, he was still limited. And you have these struggles where you don't call Parliament and you try to find other ways to get money. You go to the French and ask the French for money or whatever, so you don't have to call Parliament. So you've got this ongoing struggle then in Great Britain between, you know, both kind of religion and state and also within the political realm. And there's this, so you're developing out of this really a rule of law where you're limiting the political realm and you're limiting the discretion of the political rulers. And this experience is kind of passed on for the American experience, whereas colonists, you know, coming from Great Britain, that, you know, and the experience of American colonies is rather different than that of Spanish colonies and others, because the home countries were very different in this kind of political systems that were bequeathed. You know, the colonists who came to America had very different expectations. I mean, their expectations were that they would have the liberties of Englishmen. I mean, that was very much the rhetoric of the early American Revolution. I mean, a certain amount of it was, you know, we are being denied our rights as Englishmen. And their view, I mean, the rights of Englishmen meant you had habeas corpus. The rights of Englishmen meant you could vote for Parliament. The right, you know, they had a vision then of a limited political order. And, you know, the writings are very important, the classical liberal tradition. I mean, John Locke was one. I mean, Cato is named after Cato's letters. There were two Brits, Trenchard and Gordon, who wrote essays basically out of kind of the Whig tradition, classical liberalism. And they were circulated in the American colonies, and they called it at that time, people typically took Roman names, so they named them, they took, you know, Cato the Younger, not Cato the Elder, who was the one who said Carthage must be destroyed, and, you know, was kind of an imperialist. Cato the Younger supposedly committed suicide when, you know, Caesar took control. So this is published in the American colonies called Cato's Letters. You know, so you had a lot of this kind of literature circulating. It was very much focused on what are the rights of Englishmen, what are our rights versus the crown, limitations on the political order. And what you had is a lot of people seeking to escape what they saw as oppressive rule. So, I mean, Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded by religious dissenters. They were dissenters from the Orthodox, the Anglican Church. They themselves were a bit oppressive in how they ran things, but they wanted their own community. They didn't want to be subject to the other. You know, Maryland became known for having a lot more Catholics. Rhode Island became much more kind of dissenters. Quakers were dominant in Pennsylvania. So what you found in the American colonies were a lot of people seeking, you know, space and seeking political freedom. And what you did is created kind of a fractured political order. But they had very strong expectations in terms of what their powers would be. Very, very jealously guarded the colonial legislature. I mean, you know, the king appointed the, you know, the crown came in and gave the governor, but most of these colonies, the governor needed to have a legislature approve money. It's an enormously important limit on his power. Many of them, if the governor wanted to be paid, the colonial legislator had to approve the money. This is a very powerful kind of sanction on a governor. You know, you don't want to get these colonials too upset with you, you don't get any money. I mean, one of the causes leading up to the revolution was when the British Crown stepped in and said, we're going to stop that. We're going to start funding governors and judges and others directly from London. And that was viewed as very much a threat by the colonists because it basically eliminated their power, that power of the purse, to control the other elements within, you know, the political system. So what you had, you know, was a fairly fractured political order in, you know, the American colonies at the time. You know, and the revolution had a number of causes. I mean, the irony is that, you know, if you read the kind of the causes in the Declaration of Independence, you look at the sorts of things that animated the American colonists, I mean, what they put up with were a lot less than what we put up with. I mean, they were upset about a stamp tax. Well, I mean, you think of all the taxes that we pay these days. I mean, you think of all the regulatory impositions, you think of the controls from Washington, you think of the, you know, expansive military, any other number of things. You know, it's far greater than anything that was in the Declaration of Independence at the time. But there was an interesting essay a few years after the revolution where they sent out a young reporter to go interview one of the surviving revolutionary soldiers. You know, and kind of the, what animated this person, why did he fight? You know, so he asked the standard questions. Well, did you fight because of the, you know, go to war because of the stamp tax? He said, oh, I never bought any of those things. I couldn't care less. He said, well, how about, you know, because of the tea tax? He said, oh, I never drank tea. I didn't care for it. You know, and finally the reporter gets frustrated and says, well, what on earth did you do? And he said, well, you know, we meant to govern ourselves and they didn't mean for us to do so. I mean, a very basic sense of kind of citizen sovereignty, it's our job to govern ourselves. Not these folks from across the ocean. It doesn't matter that they're kind of, we in a certain way sprang from them in terms of political and ethnic stock. The point is, we are, you know, in our own community to govern ourselves. And if they show up and, you know, try to stop that, we're willing to go to war. And I think that what you see kind of grow out of the American experience, and I think what's very important is both philosophy and kind of legal political regime. That you have to have both of those present to have a liberal political society. You've got to have a philosophy of individual liberty, of limited government, where you know, that's the vision of people, that's the goal of the political system, is protecting individual liberty. And you've got to have a political legal order that gives effect to that, that protects that, that helps it survive. And that, at least, was the original goal of the American Constitution. You know, there are a lot of frustrations today. The president was on last night talking about health care. You know, I mean, you know, a lot of people wish they had essentially, I mean, parliamentary system at times has been described as a electoral dictatorship. There are certain things about parliamentary systems that I really like. I mean, one of them, you know, if you have an election in Great Britain, then you're, in a sense, you're done. I mean, if you're the prime minister and you have a majority, you can run, you can do what you want. You put on a three-line whip and basically everybody knows they better vote your way if they want to stay in your party and you can pass your program. You know, in the U.S., it's very hard. President wins, the Democrats take control of Congress, they run the majority of the governorships, and it's still hard for him to get anything passed. Because it turns out, you know, the House and the Senate operate differently, and the states have a different agenda, and, you know, everything kind of breaks down. And that was what was the intent of the American constitutional system. I mean, there was separation of powers very clearly within institutions. I mean, the political realm was going to be separate from other realms. I mean, it's very obvious in terms of the First Amendment, in terms of church and state. But a vision that there's the political system is apart from other elements of society. The political system is not coincident with the rest of society, so it's limited. You know, a desire to fracture government. You know, where you had federalism in terms of states versus the federal government. At that point, states really mattered, and today they matter rather less. But in the original scheme, they had very strong limitations. The federal government was an institution of enumerated powers. Again, that's something which kind of gone by the wayside. But the original vision was the federal government could only do what it was supposed to do. I mean, there was a list. You read the Constitution, Congress can do these things. It doesn't say Congress can do anything that it feels like, which is the current vision of what the Constitution says. There basically is no obvious limitation in terms of what Congress will do. None of the enumerated powers says Congress can decide who gives you health care. I mean, you know, where is a constitutional authority to say, you know, the Congress can show up and say, you have to have these people give you health care, we can control the choices you make, or any number of other things. Very little limitation these days. But the original vision was this is a limited thing. Even within the federal government, of course, there are the three branches. You know, the famous checks and balances. You know, you're going to have to get congressional approval. You know, the president can propose, but Congress disposes. You know, and the courts get to sit back and judge. So it's a very complicated system, and it was consciously created this way because the American founders were very, very concerned about concentrated political power. I mean, they had read history. They had an understanding of tyranny. They recognized how these kind of moments in history that had, you know, little liberal moments, or if you want to call them that, or democratic moments, however you want to look at, you know, the Greek republics, the Roman Republic, and others, and that these experiments have been snuffed out. So how do you protect them? So the founders, you know, had very much a vision of limited government, and they wanted to try to create a political and legal system to protect that. They wanted to create a kind of a constitutional framework that would protect that. That how do you ensure, you know, that one of the Federalist Papers, you know, famously said that, you know, I mean, we have to have government to control people, but how do we control the government? You know, you've got to be able to do both those things. You have to have a government that's strong enough to do some necessary duties, you know, in a society where people are sinful and do bad things, but you've also got to create institutions and an ethic that allows people to control the government. And that was the challenge they were trying to deal with. And it, I think, brought together then this idea that both the philosophy and the politics of both of them are very important. Unfortunately, you know, what you saw, kind of the creation in the U.S., the philosophy kind of carried on a bit, but you didn't see the follow-on elsewhere in terms of the legal and political systems. I mean, the next obvious revolution is the French Revolution. It used a lot of the same rhetoric of the American Revolution. You had a lot of American revolutionaries, like Thomas Jefferson and others, who at least initially were very kind of hopeful of the French Revolution. Jefferson wrote, that about, how important it was that, this revolution succeed and survive and kind of the future of liberty. And it played a major role in American politics. So Jefferson versus Hamilton and others led to a lot of conflict in the U.S. But the French Revolution, though it used a lot of the same terms, like liberty, very quickly descended to tyranny. I mean, that the political and legal institutions that resulted from that experience were very different. The Directorate, a whole host of things. I mean, Robespierre is one of the most famous, but I mean, they had, it went through kind of a series of cycles in terms of different, tyrants who kept murdering each other, and eventually they get down to Napoleon. The military leader basically becomes military dictator, plunges Europe into war, about 1 million people die in the various Napoleonic Wars. I mean, a hideous outgrowth where you had some of the same, some of the liberal political philosophy initially coming out of it, but the political institutions that arose were never able to give it effect. That nothing that came up was able to actually protect individual liberty. None of the political institutions were able to check each other. You didn't have anything that was able to prevent the kind of abuses that occurred. And you look throughout, and what's set in after that was very much kind of a reaction the other way. The Bourbon Restoration, I mean, they put the monarchy back in power. The Allied powers met and put the monarchy back in power in France. You had kind of a liberal moment in around 1848, different attempts at essentially classical liberal kind of revolutionary activity in Europe. Generally crushed, the Russians intervened in Austria-Hungary. There were attempts in Prussia that didn't go very far. You had, again, people out there making the argument, promoting the philosophy, but unable to give political and legal effect to these principles. And by the end of the 1800s, we're into a very different era. I mean, it was an era of where law and politics buttressed, served as buttresses for empire. And in many ways, I think a very tragic time, that kind of this whole classical liberal impulse was being limited, even in its birthplace, like Great Britain. I mean, Great Britain at that point was among the freest of the countries, but it was very much an imperial power. Robert Baden Powell, who was founded the Boy Scouts, talked at the time that we are all bricks in the wall of the British Empire. We shouldn't be kind of thinking of ourselves as individuals, but I mean, we're part of this grand empire. This is the way we should be thinking of ourselves. Much the same sentiment that one saw in Germany. I mean, people, because of World War II, people very often view World War I, pre-World War I Germany in much the same way, but it was a very different place. I mean, Wilhelmine Germany had a constitution. Wilhelmine Germany had an elected Reichstag that actually had a larger franchise than Great Britain in terms of the electorate. I mean, the problem with the German system was that cabinet ministers were responsible to the Kaiser and not to the Reichstag. But you had a rule of law there, you had civil liberties, you had protection of media freedom. I mean, you had a lot of the attributes that we think of as being aspects of a free society, but the overall philosophy was one, becoming a Weltmacht. We need to have our place in the world, our place in the sun, that the other great imperial powers have been out there kind of conquering the world, and we haven't been part of it. We need to get our share, this sort of thing, which helped to, lead to the competition that gave us World War I. France, this again, kind of this birth for liberty, fraternity, equality, kind of part of the slogan, but it was very much a revanchist power, desperate to get Alsace and Lorraine back, very angry in certain ways, nationalist passions, had gone through some populist exercises, had gone through its own kind of tyranny of, Napoleon's cousin, Napoleon III, who got beaten by the Germans in the Franco-Prussian War. So it had gone through these periods, but also individual liberty was not terribly important at this point. Very much kind of the French nation, the idea of getting lost territory back, very, very important. Russia was, kind of the great Slavic power, the Tsar, anti-Semitic kind of despotism to the east. It had moments, it had some prime ministers and others who had more liberal impulses. It had kind of a quasi-revolution in 1905 that ended up dissipating. You're ending up, as you get up to World War I, you have this continent full of imperial competitors. you know, we're basically, what matters is the empire. It's kind of territory. It's a question of greatness for us. And even the United States, I mean, the United States went through its own period at this time. The progressives became much more important, so a lot more economic control. The U.S. finally got into over what we call saltwater imperialism. The Spanish-American War, 1890, was really the first exercise of military power outside of American boundaries. The U.S. traditionally had been very aggressive domestically in expansion. Manifest destiny, as it was called, you know, it was, we are destined to overspread the continent, you know, and if that means, you know, seizing half of Mexico and slaughtering the Indians, so be it. You know, we're going to do what destiny has required. You know, it's kind of nice when you can claim destiny for your, you know, your whatever goals you have. Spanish-American War was the extension of that overseas. The U.S. Decided that, you know, the Filipinos had been struggling against Spain, so the U.S. went to war against Spain nominally over Cuba. But we heroically decided that we should take the Philippines as well. And of course, those silly Filipinos, Catholics as they were, needed to be Christianized, so America should take over from the Spanish. Filipinos weren't so impressed, and we fought a war that killed roughly 200,000 Filipinos. The U.S. eventually adopted the policies of Cuba that had been using, that the U.S. had criticized, to suppress the insurrection. So the U.S. kind of gained its own, you know, colonies throughout East Asia, trying to look towards expansion towards China. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is viewed as an icon by some today, and he's a fascinating character, but he really was, in many ways, exhibited the worst tendencies. He loved war. He thought the U.S. should go to war variously with Great Britain, with Spain, with Germany, and, of course, against savages who needed to be uplifted. I mean, he was very much an economic interventionist. You know, he kind of loved, kind of exalted the state. I mean, someone who was fascinating, but nevertheless is certainly not an exemplar of the normal ideals that any of us would hold. And collectivism really was ascendant at this time, even in the United States. And as we get into World War I, which I would argue is the great tragedy, you see all of these worst impulses, you know, come to the fore. I mean, the 20th century, you know, certainly as it began, was the catastrophe for limited government and individual liberty. I mean, despite these empires around, almost most of these empires were reasonably liberal. I mean, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is this kind of ramshackle place where you've got the Austrians and the Hungarians kind of share authority in kind of an odd, messy way. And there are attempts to, you know, uplift the Slavs, and there's a struggle over Bosnia, and all this complicated stuff's going on. But for the most part, if you lived in Austro-Hungary, you know, it's not a police state. You're not going to be thrown in jail. I mean, as long as you're not killing people, you can kind of do your thing. You know, and I mean, you know, Russia, you know, at least if you're part of the more educated or mercantile classes, you can live a reasonable life. If you're a peasant, it's a pretty awful place. But, you know, these are not, they're not dragging you off to the gulag. You know, their police are fairly inefficient. If you're not an anarchist trying to assassinate the Tsar, you'll probably get by okay. You know, that for the most part, what you've got in all of these countries are more or less constitutional orders of some sort. They're not focused on individual liberty, but they do give a certain amount of individual space. So it's a world where one could imagine expanding in a proper, in a good direction. You know, there are struggles in Germany, the Reichstag have, you know, votes and whatever. I mean, you could kind of see this stuff. You're hoping for evolution towards more democratic and more and freer societies. But then World War I happens. In World War I, I mean, it's, you know, very complicated, the most studied month in human history. It's been called, you know, the June 28th, 1914, Archduke of Austro-Hungary is shot and murdered in Sarajevo by basically Serbian terrorists who want to, they are concerned that he's going to raise up Slavs within the empire, create kind of a tri-cornered empire which would end Serbian nationalist dreams. And it's the trigger. There's a whole complicated series of reasons why. And lo and behold, we go from that to World War. Somewhere between 16 and 20 million people killed. War even reaches to the Pacific. Japan jumps in on the side of the Allies. And the great disaster there is not just the people killed during the war and the destruction of the war, but what it did to societies and the stage that it set for the rest of the century. I mean, Germany was famous for what they called war socialism. I mean, basically, to win that war, you know, governments did anything possible. So they basically seized control of entire economies. I mean, you had not only military conscription, but you had industrial conscription, control of production, control of food, rationing. I mean, almost every aspect of the society came under state control. And people looked at Germany and said, we're going to have to do the same thing. So basically, the British more or less did the same thing, the French, and even the United States. The U.S., you know, government took over the railroads. I mean, enormous extension of government control throughout the economy. It was also, you know, in the United States, it was a low point of civil liberties in America. Woodrow Wilson is viewed as this great liberal. He wanted to make it illegal to criticize the president. I mean, people went to jail. Eugene Debs, the Socialist Party candidate, Eugene Debs went to jail because at the Socialist Party convention he said, this is the capitalists' war. Ended up in jail. Even after the war ended, Woodrow Wilson would not pardon him. It was Warren Harding, the Republican who replaced Woodrow Wilson, who pardoned Eugene Debs and finally let that man out of jail. You know, people who resisted the draft, any number of things ended up in jail. You know, they had, you know, citizen vigilantes if they heard you speaking in German. You know, the hyphenated Americans. I mean, it's a very ugly time, even in the United States, despite supposed constitutional guarantees. And the outcome was catastrophe. Because the outcome was basically the entire old order of Europe was wrecked. And while it wasn't an order that we would necessarily have liked for ourselves, it nevertheless was an order within which people could live. But the outcome was, of course, the German Empire is gone and Germany's cut up. The Russian Empire is gone and now the Bolsheviks have taken control. You know, the British Empire is drained and, you know, kind of financially wrecked. The French are victorious but have a desolated landscape and are very angry. When you look throughout the continent, then you have all these, the Germans called them states for a season, throughout the Balkans. You know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is gone and it's broken up into lots of pieces. So there's now Austria and Czechoslovakia, and there's Yugoslavia. And there are all these pieces around. You know, and they all have, and of course, this is the age of ethnic states, but of course, every ethnic state has pieces of ethnic groups within them. It's a problem we saw in the Balkans in the last 20 years. So Yugoslavia has, you know, Croats and Slovenes and Serbs. You know, there's Czechoslovakia, but Czechoslovakia has several million Germans, Sudeten Germans and Sudetenland. You know, there are Poles there. I mean, all these countries suddenly, the Poles grab a lot of territory like Silesia, but that includes millions of Germans. You know, so all these new countries you create and everybody has grievances and everybody's angry. And you have the two pariah states. You have Germany, which is, you know, the goal basically out of Versailles is to ruin it and keep it basically weak economically, and then there's the Soviet Union, where the Allied powers are involved for a time at least in terms of, you know, in military involvement. They finally give up and pull out, trying to oust the Bolsheviks. So the worst aspect of this conflict is it loosed all the totalitarian viruses. So you end up with fascism in Italy, you end up with communism in Russia, and you end up with Nazism in Germany. I mean, the most virulent, the most hateful, the most hideous ideologies out there, which of course are basically complete state control of everything. And they vary a bit. I mean, the Nazis preferred to, you know, kind of control private business as opposed to run everything. The Bolsheviks, at least for a time, hoped to run everything. But the experience of all these regimes, of course, was hideous. And it also basically, you know, it kind of set us on the path to World War II. World War II is essentially the unfinished business of World War I. I mean, you know, since the balance of power was altered, but not permanently. Germany was still the most populous country on the continent, and it was angry over Versailles, felt that it had been cheated, felt that it had, you know, surrendered based on Woodrow Wilson's famous 14 points, had thrown out the Kaiser, created a republic, and it was still treated, in its view, unfairly. You know, had an unloved republic. By the end of the German democratic experience, the Nazis and the communists together held more than a majority in the Reichstag, which meant that it was absolutely impossible to form a democratically supported government through the parliament. So it basically ran on a presidential dictatorship. They used the decree power, President Hindenburg, who unfortunately was growing rapidly senile at that point. And that was about the worst point in time to have somebody growing senile, because the man who ended up appointed as chancellor, of course, is Adolf Hitler, and kind of the rest, as they say, is history. So all of this, you know, what you see here is kind of a low point of both philosophy of individual liberty and political and legal institutions to protect it. I mean, in neither of these, you know, neither the Soviet nor the Soviet systems, is there any concern for individual liberty. It is all the state. You know, the state represents everyone. People's democracies. You know, North Korea's official title is the People's Republic. Democratic People's Republic of Korea. I mean, all of them have, you know, it's the People's Republic of China. You know, these are all peoples. Of course, people don't matter. I mean, they're people's republics in which individuals mean nothing. You know, they're people's, it's just a mass. It's the collective. So all of these systems exalted the collective. And of course, there is a Soviet constitution, which if you read it, sounded really good. You know, lots of nice protections for everything. You know, but of course had no impact. You know, the Nazis, it's very interesting. I mean, the Germans, I think part of it's German culture. The Nazis, you know, remained in certain ways captured by the law. They always had to kind of do things by the law. I mean, of course, they'd still end up murdering, you know, massive numbers of people. But they would run through these legal procedures in terms of trying to kind of fit the legal, you know, dots here and crossing the T's, because it was kind of part of the culture. But as, you know, in practical terms, there was no limit. I mean, when Hitler was chosen as chancellor, he had only a minority in the cabinet. One of the Conservative Party's comments was, "We have him framed in." Well, of course, they gave Hermann Göring the premiership of Prussia, which included the Prussian police. Not a bright step. Because, you know, what you had basically at that point is you had several people who knew how to take over countries versus a bunch of political hacks. And we all kind of know how that battle turned out. So this leads us into World War II. Now, this is the, you know, the worst conflict in human history. Mass destruction, 60, 70 million dead. I mean, you know, Europe is entirely laid waste. Millions of dead in the Soviet Union. And, you know, the outcome of that, of course, now we get to the Cold War. The outcome of World War II is World War II essentially levels Europe as a geopolitical power. I mean, Britain is a victor, but Britain is broke. France is nominally a victor, but France, you know, I mean, has been occupied by the Germans. It has an internal fight. I mean, it went through its own civil war with Vichy France, which is kind of the collaborationist remnant and the resistance and everything there. So it becomes the U.S. versus the Soviet Union. So, and what you have in the Soviet Union, I mean, I think this is one where I think Reagan was absolutely right. He called it the evil empire. And it was an evil empire. I mean, you know, this, if you look at just number of people murdered, I mean, you know, the Nazi experience is unique, the desire, the attempt to exterminate an entire people. But if you just look at raw numbers, Joseph Stalin was probably the greatest murderer in human history. And Mao Zedong was probably, in terms of numbers, number two, though there are some estimates that would flip and say, you know, Mao Zedong killed a few more. I mean, we're talking about tens of millions of dead. I mean, there are a couple of very good books. There's a Black Book of Communism, which was published by a number of French intellectuals. You know, it stirred up a real storm of protest because a lot of people on the left didn't want to admit any of this. You know, they were well-intentioned. I mean, you get this weird argument in terms of the communists. So they were well-intentioned. Yeah, I mean, they killed, you know, 100 million people. You know, that strikes me as a little hard to explain how that's well-intentioned. There's also a book called Death by Government by R.J. Rummel. And both of these are extraordinary. I mean, Rummel had a passage where he talked about, you know, Stalin's desire, I mean, enemies, you know, the pressure he was putting on the NKVD, the KGB predecessor agency, you know, he needed enemies because he's convinced there are a lot of enemies around. And they would just come up with lists of people to execute, you know, and he would just checkmark them. And they needed to kill more people, so if family members would show up at the local NKVD headquarters asking about their relatives, they'd be carted off and killed. I mean, it consumed tens of millions. You know, on the other side, the United States and the Western powers, you know, are welfare states. I mean, they're certainly much freer, much better places. Though, you know, they had its own kind of collectivist element, and certainly the pressure of the Cold War, you know, the emphasis on fighting, you know, the Soviet Union. But, I, you know, if you take that up to around 1989, I mean, talking with Larry, that, you know, 20 years ago, I mean, in my view, one of the greatest events of certainly modern human history, it's the fall of the Berlin Wall. That you can, I think, argue that essentially there are roughly 90 years of the 20th century was a competition between at least some elements of a free society in various forms of collectivism and totalitarianism. And during the Cold War, the Soviet Union became that representation, and all of its the satellite states in Eastern Europe, it's, you know, had some kind of allies throughout the Third World, so-called African socialism and whatever. You know, that it really was, in some basic level, deep level, a competition with free societies, however flawed, and this totalitarian collectivist vision. And the good news is that by 1989, you know, the collectivist, the totalitarian vision collapsed completely. I mean, fascism and, you know, Nazism were destroyed in 1945, kind of imperialism and kind of policy out of the Japanese military regime in 1945 also gone. Communism lived on another 40 years, and then it was gone. And it was gone completely. I mean, this is it's something where I think it's very hard, you know, for Larry and me and others of my age, I mean, we lived through the Cold War, and the symbol of the Cold War was a Berlin Wall. Symbol of the Cold War was the notion that you had to put up walls and shoot down your own people because they wanted to escape. I mean, and to me, and you just have to think of that. I mean, you know, several hundred East Germans were murdered trying to escape East Germany. These are people who tried to crawl across the wall. People made balloons. They used submarines. They hid in automobiles. They were desperate to escape their people's republic. You know, the Democratic Republic of Germany. I mean, this is, you know, this is it. Another one of those people's republics. They tried to escape and they're shot down. And it all came to an end. And this, you know, kind of the explosion. I mean, this is where clearly the philosophy, the desire for liberty, despite all of these political structures and all of the weight of totalitarianism and all of the oppression, never disappeared. Never disappeared. And I think, you know, a lot of people deserve credit on this. A lot of it's the dissidents who kept the idea of freedom alive. It's the Vaclav Havels and others who struggled for human rights. It's, you know, dissidents like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I mean, very, very powerful writer, quirky in many ways, kind of a Russian mystic, but a man of enormous integrity. He wrote a number of novels which are devastating and critiquing the Soviet system, then wrote The Gulag Archipelago, a three-volume set. I read it when I was in college. I remember just devastating about the Soviet system, the murderous system. Somebody who was expelled from his own country because of his writings, had spent time in prison. He was imprisoned by Stalin because he wrote in one of his letters, and he referred disparagingly to the mustached one. That got him thrown in the gulag. You know. He was released after that, and that's when he wrote his books. So there are a lot of heroes. And there are also, I would argue, a number of heroes of people who were kind of reformed communists who may not have known what they were getting, but they started the ball rolling. There were some in Hungary. There were, I do think Gorbachev deserves credit, that he was the right man at the right time. What was needed was someone who would keep the troops in the barracks. I mean, at the end of the day, that was the most critical thing. You had to have somebody in the Soviet system who wasn't willing to use force and coercion to maintain the empire. And when Gorbachev goes to Eastern Europe and tells everybody, you're on your own, which is essentially what he did, you know, don't expect the Soviet troops to back you up, that really ended communism in Eastern Europe. Because that was the moment where, other than Romania with Ceausescu, other than Romania, nowhere else were any of these people willing to shoot on their own people. One of the stories in the East German Politburo was, you know, demonstrations are growing in Leipzig. And you know, there's a point where it suddenly dawned on protesters that they were getting away with it. So the demonstrations swell. And at the Politburo meeting, Ernst Honecker, the general secretary of the party, wanted to use the military. And that's the moment everybody else in the Politburo basically looked at him and said, you're crazy, and threw him out. That they were not willing to take that risk. I mean, these were thugs, but they were not mass murderers. You know, and what you found that throughout Europe. And it was an absolutely amazing moment, you know, to kind of have all of that happen. In the space of about a year, all of these totalitarian structures that had been created over decades, governments had been placed in and supported by the Soviet Union, that had police states, they had militaries behind them, you know, they built walls and had got all the stuff, it was gone. It kind of created a new world. You know, and that's where we face today, which is kind of now what? Now where do we go? And that's really what we've been dealing with over the last 20 years. And, you know, where should we move? And I think, again, we've got this kind of the two-track question. One is, what's the philosophy that we want? And then how do you create the legal and political structure, you know, to back it up? I think virtually everyone is glad communism is gone. I mean, there's a certain amount of nostalgia in East Germany for, you know, things kind of the way they were, a simpler time and whatnot. But it's very hard to be nostalgic for the Stasi. And there's a new movie out there. What was the title? I'll just encourage any of you to see The Lives of Others. It's a wonderful German film on the impact of the Stasi. I mean, I saw it on a flight actually flying to Germany, I think it was last year. A wonderful film that, in kind of a very powerful, you know, it's not a big kind of, you know, political statement, but it's looking at lives and the impact of surveillance and Stasi and, you know, what it does. You know, these were horrid times that nobody could look back on. But the question is, so what do we do now? Well, there's a certain amount of effort to come up with a third way. This got a lot of discussion back when Bill Clinton was president, Tony Blair was prime minister, Jospin was prime minister of France. You know, and the idea that we can find something between capitalism and socialism. Nobody really wants to be socialist anymore. You know, there's a certain amount of criticism in Europe of what they call Anglo-Saxon capitalism, so they want a third way. But a third way, it always strikes me, is kind of, you know, there's not much there. I mean, it's kind of capitalism with a gloss. That is, we want to have a bigger welfare state, we want to have government do some more, but it's not really an alternative. I mean, all of these systems, you know, expect to have private ownership of the means of production, all of them expect to have generally market-oriented systems. You know, so there's not a lot of difference there. Another model that I think is an interesting one that we're seeing kind of rising in this, I think China in many ways is the biggest representation of this, is kind of an authoritarian quasi-market system, where what you do is you get freer markets, but you don't have political freedom. In many ways, it's been the model of Singapore. I mean, Singapore is, you know, viewed as kind of part of, in certain ways, a Western country and whatever, but Singapore politically is not particularly free. If you're not a member of the ruling party, or your chances of getting elected aren't very well, and the likelihood of you being sued for libel, very expansively defined, is pretty high. It's not a place where you prosper if you're an opposition politician. So there are a lot of limitations on political activity there, but economically very, very free, very successful. You know, I mean, certainly a much better place to live than many places around the world. You know, in certain ways you could argue Hong Kong has been that. I mean, Hong Kong has never had political liberty, even under the British. Very free economically, but not set civil liberties, but not much political activity. But China, in many ways, is kind of trying to promote itself as being the alternative to the kind of Anglo-Saxon system, especially to talk a little about aid to Africa and whatever. You know, China is essentially going out there saying, we have a different model. We have a model where you can prosper, but you don't have to worry about all these kind of unpleasant political changes. And if you're the elite, you can maintain your control while still having a growing economy. I mean, the problem with that, of course, is that, well, political freedom is rather important. So it's obviously a system that's not based on individual liberty and limited state. It's a system that's based on continued central political control. It's not clear to me that this system will work over the long term. I mentioned a little yesterday in my talk on globalization, I think China's going to be a fascinating challenge of how it deals with continuing economic liberalization, the natural outgrowth of personal autonomy, a growing middle class. All of these things, I think, are going to make it harder to maintain political control. But it's at least being set up as a kind of an alternative competitive system. You know, what the West seems to have come up with today and what the United States seems to be modeling, and you could argue maybe places like Russia are moving in that direction, is this kind of highly interventionist mixed economy. You know, should the United States still be called a free society? I mean, I hear that all the time, we're a free country. Well, we're certainly freer, but you know, there are times where I start wondering if we should really call ourselves a free country, just given all the restrictions, all the spending, all the new things. I mean, you think about what has been happening since last fall. We've basically had about $13 trillion of bailouts in the United States. It's hard to think of a genuine capitalist system where you get that. That's essentially the equivalent of the U.S. GDP. So the U.S. has spent 1 year of its production bailing out everybody who's failed. Well, that's not exactly what I normally think of as capitalism. You know, the U.S. is going to have a $2 trillion deficit this year. Over the next 10 years, it's going to have roughly a $10 trillion deficit, assuming no new spending. So forget, you know, healthcare reform and forget cap and trade and forget all these other proposals. If you just assume where we're at today, it's another $10 trillion, which is, you know, so we're kind of adding yet another annual GDP, you know, to that. Medicare and Social Security have, in terms of unfunded liabilities, about $100 trillion unfunded liabilities. Those are things which most of you in this audience will be paying for me. I thank you very much. So if you look at the U.S. system, I mean, what we have is a pretty interventionist system which is kind of expanded into almost an entitlement society on economics. You know, I mean, if you make dumb mistakes and you can, you know, to convince people you're too big to fail, you get bailed out. You know, and of course, with that come a lot of other assumptions. I mean, congressmen are now hearing from constituents who are mad because they're not getting loans from banks that got money from the federal government. Their view is, well, if their tax monies were used to bail out the bank, they deserve money. I mean, you just kind of see where this can be carried forward. And this is what we're seeing in many ways, to varying degrees throughout Europe. I mean, Russia has clearly had a very bad experience, and I think part of it's just very hard to jump from kind of a totalitarian collectivism to democratic capitalism. But, you know, where the nomenclature and the elite kind of took advantage of privatization, where it had a lot of oligarchs and everything. And what you see now in Russia and a number of other countries, Ukraine and others, is pretty heavy state intervention, more bailouts, state control. Russia's been moving back with the government taking control of especially energy industry and other ones as well. So you could argue there's a certain amount of convergence here, of more political control of economies, more intervention, more of a mixture than a kind of a free society. The alternative, and the one that I would promote, and the one that I think most people at Fee would support, is basically moving back towards a genuinely free society. You know, a vision that a lot of people have been talking about this week. And to my mind, that needs to be put on the table and pushed as an alternative, because we're living in a world now of influx, where we had, you know, dramatic political changes over the last 20 years, transformation of the international landscape. We're currently in a time of enormous economic flux, with bailouts and where do we go and how do we fix the economy and all these sorts of things being debated. And I would argue that what the founders of the U.S. government showed enormous foresight. You know, there's a tendency you hear today that, well, you know, the system they set up was best for a simple rural society, right? You know, it's okay for those kind of common folk and whatever to have this small limited government, but we live in such complicated times and sophisticated society and everything, we've got to have a big, powerful, wonderful, strong government. Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, a question came up, and I guess it was two nights ago, you know, like, what should government do, or what can government do well? Well, what government does well is not sophisticated things. Government does not do well complicated things. Government doesn't do well sensitive things. What government can do well is blowing up other societies. I mean, you know, you put in a call to Washington and say, I want you to level Baghdad, no problem. You know, we can send in the bombers and we'll take care of it. But if it's, we want you to remake the society, we want you to figure out a way to get Shia and Sunni and Kurds to live together, a lot harder. You know, and that's the problem in almost all of these issues. You know, it's easy to say, we want you to write checks to people on welfare. It's very hard to say, oh, by the way, please don't wreck the communities and families along the way. We haven't quite figured that one out. So in fact, there's good reason not to want to make politics the dominant feature of all of these issues. The more complicated life gets, the harder it becomes for central planners and central controllers, whether economically or politically, to fix things. So there's a far better argument for decentralization. And their concern over kind of the problem of humanity, the problem of original sin, the problem of concentrated interest groups, the problems of factions. You know, they didn't call it public choice economics at the time, but they certainly understood that, the role of factions. You know, they understood all of those things, which is why they created a government that would be hard to pull together and to operate and to kind of move forward, because they understood all of those things were dangerous. And they're absolutely right. That this is something where they really got it right. That they could look down the road and know that these are eternal principles and eternal problems that will not disappear no matter how sophisticated we consider ourselves to be, how cultured, how civilized, how any number of other things. And in my view, of course, it doesn't just apply in the United States. I mean, poor countries that have suffered through dictatorship and collectivist craziness and, I mean, you know, the Peronists and who knows what else if you're Argentinian or, I mean, madness, various madnesses that have afflicted Brazilian governments or any other number. I mean, you know, Ceausescu regime in Romania, any number of these things. Everyone, I think, understands, and certainly poor countries, are more vulnerable to this. If you have more fragile societies, you're poorer, you have less room for error. And the problem is the desire to control the state is much higher. Because if politics becomes the most important thing in society, you know, I mean, one of the odd things about America, but a useful thing is, you know, there are all these kind of, if you lose a political election, you don't disappear into the gulag, you're not shot, you know, you end up go to a think tank, right? You know, John Bolton, you go to American Enterprise Institute and give speeches and write articles for the Wall Street Journal. Now, so it doesn't matter as much who controls the government. You still want to win the election. But if you don't win the election, you don't lose everything. In a lot of societies, if you lose the election, you lose everything. Your family loses everything. I mean, suddenly that is a winner-take-all competition that is so much more important. And that makes it so much more dangerous. I mean, yet another reason why you want to divide power. You want to separate responsibilities. You want to ensure that controlling the state doesn't mean you control absolutely everything. So I would like to see the United States, and of course I would encourage other countries to follow, but I try not to lecture other countries on what they should do. U.S. Secretary of State does that enough. I figure I don't need to add my you know, 20 cents. But the U.S. should return to a vision of a limited government. That, and it strikes me that, you know, where it's a much more limited role for politics. One where I would argue, and again, there's, within libertarian ranks, there's always been division between anarchists and kind of mini-state, if you want to call it that, people, limited government people. As I indicated, you know, that I want to see progress in my lifetime, I kind of take that on the philosophical area as well. If I can ever get to a point where the relevant argument is, do you have private roads or not, I'm happy to have that argument. Today it doesn't strike me as being terribly relevant. So I'd like to just shrink a lot of the stuff we're doing now and get government out of the obviously bad things, and then I'll argue the kind of other things. You know, if somebody wants to convince me of privatizing national defense, I'm open to that, but let's get rid of the, you know, Labor Department and the Commerce Department and the Energy Department and a whole bunch of others first, and then we can have the argument about Pentagon. So what we need is basically a system that defends a free society. It's a framework for the interaction of human beings in terms of the problem of the intersection of people who have rights, and when those come into conflict, question of contracts, question of crime, the, you know, and I think there are some genuine collective problems, and the question is, are there some of these which you can't handle privately? Government should be the last resort, not the first resort. I'll talk later today about pollution, for example. Aspect of pollution is the lack of property rights. Some areas, I think you can create property rights and solve the problem, but what do you do about air? What do you do about water? Some of these things you may very well need some collective political action. But in general, it's a pretty limited role. It doesn't mean government's going to become the redistributor of income for everyone. Doesn't mean the government's going to rejigger outcomes and decide what's just. Doesn't mean that the government's going to try to create a better society and turn us all into moral human beings. You know, doesn't mean that the government's going to be soul molding. You know, the whole idea of social engineering at home and abroad, I think, is completely inconsistent with that of a free society. And I do have to say, I have been struck, especially during the Bush years, of conservatives who never liked the idea of social engineering in America, who became enthused about social engineering abroad. I mean, the notion that people could sit in Washington and figure out how to kind of transcend traditions and histories and ethnicities and religion and fix other societies. I mean, they can't fix, I mean, go down in Manhattan, if you take the train down, 125th Street is Harlem. It's gotten a lot better in recent years, but it's one of the poorer areas America. Go fix Harlem. If Washington can't fix Harlem, how is it going to fix other societies? That the sense of limitations is one that we should have a lot more humility in terms of what we try to do and what we expect government itself to do. And as part of this, I'll just try to wrap it up fairly quickly. I think it needs, one, we need to revitalize government. That is, government shouldn't do very much. What it does, it should do well. It's a scandal that poor people in poor neighborhoods are killed in criminal activity. It's a scandal if the government's going to have government schools that children get murdered in government schools. I mean, if the government cannot protect people's safety, what is it doing telling us it's going to figure up how to run our health care? We need to have a government that does what it is supposed to do. Well, do that well before you come and tell me all the new things you're going to do. In Washington, D.C., every couple years, a kid is killed in school. And the principal invariably says there is nothing we could do. Well, this is an outrage. You know, the government says, essentially, you've got to go to public schools, otherwise you pay twice and all this stuff. You know, we've got a kind of a public school monopoly. And especially if you're poor, it's real hard not to go to them. But we won't teach your kids anything. They don't learn anything in government schools. And we can't keep them safe. But they have to come. If you don't send them, you can go to jail. So, government itself, not a lot it should do, but boy, it should do well what it's supposed to do. To me, that is an outrage, and it shouldn't be asking to do other things if it can't do that well. We should revitalize the Constitution. I mean, we've seen in terms of American legal jurisprudence how hard it is to make kind of enforce paper guarantees. A number of us joke that the best amendment to the Constitution would be to add to every paragraph a parenthesis that says, and we mean it. No property shall be taken but for public use and compensation, parentheses, we really mean this, right? You know, Fourth Amendment, you're supposed to, searches and seizures absent probable cause, parentheses. And yes, this applies today, right? And that's kind of, if we kind of did that throughout, maybe that would help. Then what we need to do is enforce a constitution where it's not perfect, and it's not a purely libertarian document. But if you read through the Constitution, you understand the desire to limit government power, and especially the notion the federal government had limited enumerated powers. Federal government was not a general government that could do anything that it wanted. States had a lot of authority. The feds were limited to the enumerated powers. We should revitalize that. I think we need to revitalize, essentially, kind of citizenship in the sense of people have to be more active in demanding to control their government. You know, when I talk, especially to younger audiences, I always try to emphasize, you know, if you aren't involved, decisions will still be made, right? I mean, the problem is people in Washington will not say, well, I guess if the people aren't going to vote, I guess we won't do anything. They're happy, right? They will make decisions. People in Washington are very, very happy to make decisions for all of you and everybody else across America. So it's not enough to be frustrated and complain. It requires action. And not everybody's going to be a policy nerd like me. But it does require activity to demand and hold accountable political figures at state, local, and federal levels. Because if they are not held accountable, they will do what they do today. I mean, they will pass massive expenditures, and they'll pass lots of money to their friends, and they'll make sure the spending bills benefit their interest groups. I mean, Barney Frank helped get us into this by supporting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Then, he's kind of one of the important guys in drafting the legislation to save us all. And then he's involved telling the feds to make sure money goes to banks in his district. I mean, you run the system coming and going. You create a crisis, and now you're indispensable to solve the crisis. And while you're solving it, you make sure your buddies get taken care of. This is very, very common for Washington. This is a sort of person who needs to be held accountable. So we need to revive that sense that it's not enough to be frustrated, but in fact, people across the board have got to be very active in this. So average citizens, political activists, everyone. We also need to revive civil society. You know, there's this tendency to assume, you know, on a lot of people's parts, you know, I gave at the office, why should I have to solve problem X? The more social problems there are, and the less attempt there is to solve them outside of government, the greater the pressure to have government solve them. Far better if we step up and do things ourselves. It's private organizations, it's churches, it's, you know, private NGOs. I mean, any number of groups out there, community, independent sector, a lot of things out there. But if we want to help push back the state, one of the things we need to do is expand the private sector. And it was once there. The problem is the state is the ultimate imperialist institution. It will take over everything that it can if it's able to. I mean, religious orders were once much more, you know, active in terms of hospitals. Active in terms, I think you're going to hear a talk, I think Sheldon's talking about, you know, this society. So you'll get a bit of this with Sheldon's talk of some of the kind of active, benevolent activities of fraternal organizations, labor unions, and others. Once very, very active. A lot of these pushed out through regulations and a lot of other things. But we've got to push back. Bill Clinton, you know, said during his presidency when welfare reform came up, he argued, he said, every church in America should adopt a welfare recipient and get them off welfare. Now, you can argue it's difficult in that, in many ways, you know, lots of the churches are located in places where there aren't a lot of welfare recipients. I mean, the reality is the inner city has a lot more problems in these areas, and a lot of the churches are somewhere else. But it still struck me it was a good idea in that one of the advantages of a church is it will speak to more than just your material needs. It'll speak to the whole person. To the extent you can get to know somebody and know a family and know their needs, you can do a lot more than just cutting them a check. The response of Reverend Pennybacker of the National Council of Churches at the time was, well, we're not going to do government's job for it. And my reaction is, well, what on earth, what do you mean government's job? If you as a churchman promoting the gospel is not, your job is not to help uplift people in need, what is your job? That is your job. Now, we can argue, if you don't do it and other people don't do it, okay, maybe we need to go to government. But the starting point isn't Washington. It should never be Washington. The starting point should be way back here. And that's something where I encourage, especially among libertarians, I mean, there's an element in which libertarians are viewed, you know, kind of it's all green eye shade and take care of myself, that if we want to push government back, the more that we do ourselves to help deal with these problems, the more we're going to be able to push government back. If we don't help deal with these problems, the pressure on government to do more is going to continue, very importantly. You know, liberty is not the end, it strikes me, the kind of the end of existence. It's not the highest human goal. It's the highest political end. Liberty allows us to do other things. It allows us to fulfill our objectives, our lives, live a good life, any number of things, whatever our life's objectives are. A liberal society, a society that values individual liberty, allows us to do that. And that, to me, is why it's so important. It's not that liberty itself is the highest end, but it allows us to fulfill what we believe to be our highest ends. So it's an end that's very much worth fighting for. And today, it's a critical time to do so. There really is a sense of the politics remains very much in flux. We've had this grand event 20 years ago where hundreds of millions of people were basically freed from among the worst tyrannies ever. We live at a time where we're seeing continuing transformation of major countries like China, where we're seeing people who are living much better than they did 10, 20, 30 years ago. And we see a time of enormous economic challenge even in the West, even in a country like the United States. So all of this stuff is kind of up in the air. So it strikes me that you all are active at a very important time. And I think that we have to return to and kind of promote again this vision of a limited government of individual liberty. It's a vision that made sense when it was pushed. It's a vision that made sense when the founders tried to create political and legal institutions to encapsulate it. And it's a vision that makes sense today. It's one which I encourage all of you to go out and promote. And if so, I think we'll all be better off for it. And I'll end there and happy to take any questions.
You touched on religion a little bit, and I was wondering what your view is of as many agnostics and atheists and apathetic people. How do you look at rights granted by God and the view, how's that going to affect that? Is it people are thinking government is giving them the rights, or is there a replacement for that, or how is that affecting things, you think?
Well, I mean, set aside whatever one believes theologically, I think if one believes that someone is created in the image of God, I think it's a very strong bedrock for individual rights. Because the value of that is to say there's a transcendent moral value in every human being tells you that the political authorities have no right to just kind of show up and say dismiss it. I mean, you cannot treat people as a mass if you believe every individual has value in the eyes of God and is created in the image of God. So to my mind, and it's why some people like civil religion. I mean, Eisenhower once said, we all need religion, I don't care which one. Right. I mean, his view was just important. But the problem is you can't very well go out and tell people, please believe, because if you believe, then it's easier for us to do our thing. I think that certainly Rand is one. I mean, there are a lot of folks out there that have tried to construct a vision of rights in a kind of a moral system completely separate from God. And it strikes me, we live in a secular republic, so I happen to be religious, but it doesn't strike me as telling me very much in terms of how I order the political system, because I don't believe the political system should be used to promote the religious beliefs. I think the certain set of religious beliefs are a good foundation, so one can draw on those, but at the end, we're going to have a public discussion in the public arena where we can talk to one another. So we're going to have to talk in language that we both understand. So I think one can talk about human dignity and life. I mean, if you believe life, human beings are the highest form of the evolutionary process. There's an obvious value there. It suggests they should be treated in a unique way. I mean, I think there are other ways to speak about, these things, and I think we need to draw on those. So I wouldn't just try to tie on one. I think we're going to have a very expansive discussion, and I think we can do so.
You were talking about the state should have less responsibilities and stuff, and just hope that it does a lot of bad job. And what would you say to a country like Brazil that people used to think our schools are terrible, but it's better to give bad education than non-education, or people are really poor, they could never reach for a health system. It's not better to have a terrible bad health system than no system?
Well, I guess what I'd say in those cases that at the very least, the state should be the backup. There's a lot of evidence that you get a lot of private education in poor countries. I mean, Cato is publishing a book. I think we've had a policy forum on it that, I don't know if you remember, but on it, where there's enormous amount of educational activity in poor countries, because it doesn't cost a lot. I mean, American slaves were educated. A lot of times it had to be underground. It was illegal, but I mean, there was literacy. So what I would say in those, I mean, again, I, you know, if, is the only way you can educate kids to have the government. If you believe that, well, then that'd be an argument for government doing it. But I don't see any evidence in human history that that's the case. I mean, Sheldon can speak more on this. Sheldon's written a book on the role of public education. But the American common schools, much of the kind of common school movement, the public school movement, was an attempt to prevent all those silly papists who were showing up, those new Catholics. They didn't want them infecting, you know, kind of the young people. So they wanted to have public schools that would basically teach kind of a deracinated Protestantism. I mean, it's very clear. You read the literature. I mean, this is, you know, they wanted kind of a civil religion that was going to be Protestant-tinged. And that was much of the emphasis on the idea we need a common education or whatever. So it wasn't because nobody could get educated. There are lots of ways to get educated. So, I mean, you know, the question of healthcare is much the same thing. I mean, the question is, do any of these countries have good healthcare systems? You know, my guess is that if, you know, the politicians in the capital city would stop stealing, you know, and they wouldn't create massive monopolies, and, you know, you wouldn't have Petrobras and, I mean, any number of these state enterprises that suck, all of these, and all, of course, subsidized by the World Bank. I have a friend who was in the World Bank desk for Brazil. I mean, just tell me stories about, you know, I mean, all the state enterprises that are getting all these huge loans, and the money just kind of disappears, but then there's a new loan, you know, a few more years later, and money disappears. But, of course, it all has to be repaid. So, I mean, money's stolen and wasted prodigiously by these societies. Well, if you weren't stealing local people's resources, they'd be a lot more able to do these things. So, I mean, I'm quite open if you come in and say, government has to be a safety net. We've got to have some minimal standard out there for, you know, people who just can't do it otherwise. Even in that case, I'd say, well, don't have a government school. We'll give you some money and let you go. I mean, you know, even there, it doesn't mean the government should run them. It doesn't mean the government should provide them. And in the U.S., for the most part, doesn't do that. We don't say people are hungry, therefore we need government restaurants. I mean, you can argue about how well food stamps and stuff work, but they certainly make a lot more sense than, I mean, can you imagine a government, you know, walk down Madison Avenue in Manhattan and have the government restaurant, you don't have to show your proof. I mean, it'd be a nutty way to do it. It's how we're doing education. So there's no reason, even if you see a need that needs to be met to some degree by the state, that doesn't tell you it should be state provision, state control, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay, so you're suggesting that the government should just try to stimulate the people to do that, but the government itself not do that? I mean, for example,
the first thing I would say is it'd be far better if the government wasn't stealing from people, making it very hard for them to do it themselves. I mean, my guess, I mean, I think I mentioned yesterday, I mean, there's a long kind of theory of economics that basically suggested poor people in poor countries were dumb. And that is simply not the case. I mean, that is just not the case. Poor people in poor countries know their kids need education. They can't, but if they have no resources, they can't do it. Well, the first step then is to have a system where they're able to have some resources, where they're not blocked. I mean, the whole, you know, Hernando de Soto's wonderful work in Peru, The Other Path. I mean, there's a whole set of entrepreneurs out there who are operating outside the legal system. So they have no property rights. They don't own their property. They can't get mortgages. They can't, I mean, all host of things. They're very entrepreneurial. But the legal system is organized against them for the benefit. They call the capitalists, it's the elite. It's the people who are manipulating the system. So then the problem is, okay, let us assume this system. Now what do we do for the poor people who've basically been stolen from by their own government? Boy, I mean, this is a great deal for the government. It takes the money, wastes it, and then, you know, comes in and says, we have to now help you.
Program that actually pays the families like $50 a month, so they don't have that excuse to say that the poor families have nothing. They kind of receive some money, so they should be able to buy and to educate kids, etc. But they actually think that they would not be able, nobody on the region would be able to save money enough to like build a hospital or a school. So that's why they always see the government, the state, as being so.
But yeah, and it strikes me, it makes a lot more sense to pay poor families than to say we're going to show up and build the school and run it and decide on everything. Brazil has experimented, I mean, the problem of child labor, one thing it's tried to do, and I haven't heard how the program's worked out, is pay families to keep their kids in school. The families that feel economic pressure to have their kids work say instead, if you keep your kids in school, we'll pay you to essentially cover that cost. I mean, that strikes me, in an imperfect world, is a good approach to try to help Because, I mean, you want to break the cycle of poverty. Then, I mean, if kids don't get educated, they will be in the same situation that, like the brickyard I mentioned. This will never end. That strikes me as being at least an attempt to say, how do we get in there recognizing families are responding to desperation, ease the desperation, and ensure that the next generation isn't there. So, I mean, some of these things, I mean, my basic problem is so often what the government does is comes in and creates the problem. And then says, oh, look at the crisis. We will solve it. Right? Give us more money, give us more control, and trust us, we'll make it better. And then, of course, they muck it up again. And then, oh, whoa, another problem. Because everything's kind of independent. They act as if nothing's connected. And it's always, we need to do more. It's never, look at the mess you've made, and let's maybe move you back and clean up the mess.
What you're saying about UN, the UN and the UN Charter and those social, economic, and cultural rights. And just one small moment, comment. Actually, in Guatemala, the government has started their own restaurants for people to...
Oh, my. Oh, that'll probably become an idea from the U.S. I hope the U.S. never hears about that. So Guatemala started restaurants for poor people. Question of the UN, UN Charter of Rights. I mean, the problem with the UN, I mean, it's long kind of within... you know, kind of philosophical circles. Some degree you talk about positive and negative rights. I mean, typically when we talk about human rights, we talk about what's called negative rights. You know, government should not show up and prevent you from, you know, speaking. It shouldn't come and kill you. I mean, it can't come and throw you in jail because of whatever. I mean, you have a right to basically fulfill your desires without the government coming in and stopping you. Or somebody else, I mean, you know, a criminal shows up and wants to steal your money. I mean, you have a right to continue, and you have a right not to be oppressed in this way. Positive rights means you have a right to go up and grab her and say, I need money, thank you. And go to him and say, I need health care, please pay for it. You go to him and say, oh, I need education, by the way, could you pay for my education? Oh, I need a car. I mean, that's what positive rights are. So the positive rights are always, I have a right to education. What does that mean? You certainly have a right to seek education. And nobody should interfere with you. But does that mean you have a right to demand somebody pay for it? Well, who? I don't know. Who, right? And does it mean you have a right to elementary and secondary, or does it include college? How about post? I mean, I have a law degree. Does that mean you have a right to force somebody to send you to Stanford Law School? Go to Harvard? You know, I don't know. I mean, so the problem that strikes me with the positive rights is they're not rights at all. I mean, it's basically a right to steal. I mean, you get to define what you want and you call it a right. There are certainly good social objectives. I want people to have education. But do you have a right to an education? And what they mean is, it's always in terms of, you know, the government's supposed to provide it. What does that mean? Well, the government has to take resources from somebody and do something. So I think we should be very careful when people get into this kind of, when we're talking about rights, I think, I mean, it really is a question of protecting our liberties from interference from others. We have to be very careful when we start saying we have a right to fill in the blank. I have a right to health care. Well, what does that mean? You have a right to every new procedure that's available out there, irrespective of cost. And if so, who has to pay? The rich? Everybody? The government? I mean, so that's my problem. And those UN, they're all wonderfully written and expand. I mean, you read that and it's very hard to deny any of that. Oh yeah, right to education, right to, you know, this, right to that. But it doesn't really have any meaning. What it means is you have a right to force other people to provide it. Well, I don't see how that's a right. I mean, that's what, you know, I don't see how you can say you have a right to make undetermined numbers of people provide you with an undetermined numbers of goods and services, which is really what it comes down to as you read. And they typically mix them. So, I mean, you know, you have a right not to be tortured. Well, that's certainly true. And I have a right to education. Well, these are very different things. I mean, it's just not, I mean, like, you know, FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, the freedoms, you know, it's the freedom from want. Well, what is that? I mean, it's kind of like you have a freedom, apparently your freedom is to have somebody feed you or something. I mean, you know, I mean, it sounds good, but it doesn't have any real meaning in terms of conceptually who has to do this, what, you know, what does it mean to have that? Freedom from, does that mean if I want a Porsche, somebody has to give it to me? I really want a Porsche. I have a freedom from want. Somebody needs to give me a Porsche, right? I mean, or is it just a Volkswagen? You know, I don't know. So I think that's the problem. I'd be very careful when we get into the rights language and it expands that way, because there's really no end point.
Okay, so you think that the UN is an effective organism, or should be, like, destroyed? Or like you
Well, I guess I would say, kind of as President Clinton said, you know, it depends on how you define is. How do you define effective? Effective at what? If you have an institution that essentially has 200 members, of whom, I don't know, you know, 20 members provide probably 90% of the funding or 95% of the funding, and more or less the same 20 members are the only countries that have real militaries that can fulfill peacekeeping in any sensible form. This is just an organization, the Security Council, which is created based on the balance of power after World War II, it's not going to work very well. The organization is not created in a way to work very well. You're talking about bureaucracy. I mean, Boutros Ghali, who is the Secretary General, like, I don't know, three ago or something, was asked at one point, how many people work at the UN? Now, he's the Secretary General of the UN. And his response was, oh, about half of them. I mean, this is the attitude of the man who runs, at that point, ran the UN. I think there are some functions for which some specialized agencies, in theory, can work. I mean, I think, you know, problems of refugees. I mean, we get huge, huge problems. Conflict in the Congo, there are literally millions of refugees over the border into desperately poor countries. Right? Countries cannot handle that. They can't handle their own needs. Well, it's nice to have some international organization to try to help. Now, I mean, the UN operations, you know, they send in peacekeepers. There's child abuse. There's lots of horrid stuff that's come out of some of the UN things. But at least in principle, it strikes me, refugee relief. I think the International Atomic Energy Agency, if you want to promote nonproliferation, it helps to have a theoretically independent agency. It's not just a U.S. thing, but, you know, so there's certain specialized agencies I would say may be useful. But, I mean, the bulk of the institution, I mean, I think we could make a lot better use of that very fine land on the East River down in Manhattan. There may be value in having kind of an international forum in which people can vent, you know, kind of scream and say silly things, which is what basically the General Assembly is. I mean, they put out reams of paperwork. I mean, I was involved in the Law of the Sea Treaty Conference many years ago. I had to get a four-drawer, it was a file cabinet, but it was a safe, because it was all this stuff was classified and all this crap, about all these UN papers. I mean, masses of papers, just endless. So I would say, in general, the UN is not very effective, which does not mean that there are no things for which there may not be value of some specialized agencies, but I wouldn't spend a lot of time, you know, trying to revive it and make it, I just think it's almost forlorn hope. I mean, again, you just think of the numbers. 200 countries are members and kind of can vote. 20 countries account for all the cash. I mean, you just think of the incentive structure that creates, just in terms of a budget, and then you take it from there in terms of anything else, and real hard.
Limiting government seems to be very hard, and Congress tends not to limit itself. But after all, it looks like you need someone with legal training to destroy limited government, and these guys are the Supreme Court. How do you feel about the Supreme Court today, and what's going on with Sotomayor? And it looks like the interpretation of the Constitution have been changed a lot in the U.S. Is there a way back? You think the Supreme Court, well, it's not a four-year term. People stay there until they're very old. Is there a way back to a limited government vision of the Constitution?
Well, if you could get the right appointees to the Supreme Court, I mean, if you had 9 Richard Epsteins on the Supreme Court would be rather different. I mean, even 5 Richard Epsteins would be enough. You get a majority and everything. It's going to be real hard. I mean, Sotomayor, I think, is a perfectly decent person, but I think is very much a liberal activist. The hearings are always a game. Basically, what the hearings do now is provide you an opportunity to deny everything you ever said or wrote. Right, so anything, I didn't really mean that, and that's out of context, and actually I didn't really mean that either, you know, and I don't believe that. And, I mean, that's why somebody like a John Roberts is essentially, as far as I could tell, I think he was very ambitious, basically tried to say absolutely nothing about anything interesting. I mean, you know, you get to a point where Clarence Thomas denied that he'd ever even thought about Roe v. Wade. Now, you're a lawyer, and this is the most important, the most controversial, in my view. Forget the issue of whether or not you think abortion should be legal or not. Probably one of the worst constitutional decisions ever. And you're trying to tell me you as a lawyer have never thought about this? I mean, my reaction would be that tells me you're not competent and shouldn't be on the court. But of course, oh, really? That's very interesting. And you move on to the next question. So I think that's kind of the game she played. I mean, she kind of ran away from all of her previous rhetoric about Latina woman and all these other things. So I think that she will be very much in the, she will fit, I mean, a suitor. I mean, she'll be in the stream of kind of the fairly liberal activist court. I mean, the problem is one of interpretation. You know, what is your vision? Is it the living constitution? My view is that judicial interpretation, you shouldn't be focused on is it activism or restraint. The question is, are you actually interpreting the Constitution? Constitution at times requires activism. If it says, you know, you can't have searches and seizures without probable cause, that means that the court should be active and strike down searches that don't have, I mean, you know, it says it limits the taking of private property. Well, the court should be active and, you know, defending individual liberty there. So to some degree, the conservative liberal argument strikes me as the wrong one. I don't want judges to do nothing. I want judges to, you know, have fidelity to the law and the Constitution. And I really wish they'd actually read the Constitution, not just the previous decision. Because, I mean, at this stage, so many of these decisions are just kind of, I mean, it's all judge-made law. I mean, that's where Sotomayor was caught on tape saying, it was one of these wonderful levels. She said, well, I probably shouldn't say this because the TV cameras are going, because that's when you really perk up. She said, you know, the appellate court is where the policy is really made. And she's right. Because, you know, most cases are not going to be taken by the Supreme Court. It only gets a very few cases. So if you win at the appellate level, you normally win the case, which means that's they get to kind of decide everything. And she was being very blunt about it. What you need is a lot more judges who are willing to say, well, if it's really policy, it's not our job. You know, it's somebody else's job. And who, will, you know, basically will not become aiders and abettors of expanded government. And that's essentially what has happened, that a failure to enforce the enumerated clause, and basically enumerated powers, to kind of say, well, Congress, I don't see anywhere here where you get to do this, and kind of wildly expanding ambiguous clauses. I mean, commerce, but you know, interstate commerce. Well, if you really believe interstate commerce is what they now say it is, which is anything anywhere that might have some vague impact anywhere on anything, well, then nothing else in the Constitution matters. There's no reason to give enumerated powers if this one clause means the government can do anything that it wants. That's really what it says. I mean, it goes back to the Great Depression. You grow crops on your own land for you to eat. Not, there's no cross-state activity. Doesn't matter, because if you are growing that, it changes the amount of food being sold somewhere across some state boundary. Well, that's ludicrous. I mean, that was not, the founders weren't imagining that. I mean, they wanted to limit federal involvement, and they wanted state autonomy and authority. So there are people like Epstein who would roll back a lot of the stuff. Typically, these things take a long time to grow, because judges typically do build on prior decisions. You kind of slowly expand. You find the precedent, you push it out. I mean, there are some like Roe v. Wade, which are major leaps. But most of these are building a little bit here, a little bit there. And so you constantly expand. You have this precedent, then you build on it. And so it'll be a long time thing. I think it requires different judges' appointments. And it's not, I don't trust Republicans on this that much more than Democrats. I mean, there are some better, but I mean, you know, the majority of the members of the court today are Republican appointees. Some of the worst, David Souter, who has gone off, was a Bush 1 appointee. I mean, some of the worst judges have been Republican appointees.
Excuse me, Doug, we have about 6 minutes left. Would you mind maybe taking a few quick questions?
Sure.
So we can get around a little bit to some other hands.
You were talking about how the government's job isn't to provide health care or welfare, which I agree with, but what then would you say is the primary goal?
I think the question, what's the primary goal of government? I think it's the framework of a free society. It's things like courts, police. It's how do you handle the interaction of sinful human beings who will do bad things to one another? How do you preserve individual rights? How do you protect the rights of individuals against those who would violate them? Is individual liberty better justified through Adam Smith's or Rand's? Well, I don't see any reason why you can't have both moral and utilitarian justifications. I'm not an objectivist, so I'm not a great fan necessarily of Rand's arguments, so I think she can persuade a lot of people. I mean, I would have, my personal would be a theological justification, which is I do believe individuals are made in the image of God, unique human, you know, unique moral human beings, And inherent to being a unique moral human being is the ability to make your own decisions and control your own life. And I think utilitarianism is a very good practical argument on top of that. Markets and freedom and other things have a lot of very important benefits practically, and I would build it on the moral foundation. So I would take a moral foundation, whether it's theistic or something else, whether Rand or somebody else, and I would add to that the utilitarianism, and I'd do both of them. I wouldn't say either or, I'd bring them together because I think it's stronger.
At what point do you think a free society crosses a point of no return and you can't fix things?
Well, when does a free society cross a point of return and you can't fix it? Well, in certain ways, I'm very much a pessimist in Washington. However, I do look back to 1989 and say, you know, a lot of people thought the Berlin Wall would stand forever. A lot of people thought, you know, the Soviet flag would fly over the Kremlin forever, and they didn't. A lot of people, I mean, the Cultural Revolution, you would have looked at China and said, oh my goodness, well, look at this. 40 years later, China's a radically different place. So I would say that the desire for liberty remains very strong amongst people, and the opportunity for it to explode, I think, remains very, very powerful, and that should give us hope. What strategies for holding politicians accountable? Certainly, I mean, the very simplest is being, you know, trying to keep track of what they're up to and keep track of issues. And I think it ranges depending upon one's position and responsibilities, but everything from letters to the editor to voting to organizing, you know, and whether it can be alternate parties. I think we need to change limits in terms of third parties. It's very hard for third parties to get on the ballot. So I would say it's kind of across the board. It can be giving money to campaigns, it can be running for office, it can be being, you know, if you're really into it, being a policy nerd and other stuff. But I think it depends a lot where we're at. But at the very least, being aware of issues, trying to convince people, it could just be your neighbors, it could just write letters to the editor. But that awareness is critical. There are a lot of people who kind of zone out and don't care. Politicians need to know that people are watching them, aware of what they're doing, writing their offices, and will take action based on what they do. And now you don't have nearly enough of that.
Do you think we can get more pro-market politicians to have incentive to be that way?
Yeah, how do we get more pro-market politicians? Well, we need more pro-market people to run. It would help to have limits in terms of the political process. Things like, I think term limits are good because we have professional political class. It's very hard. These people are very good. They use kind of they use their office to get reelected and the ombudsman role and whatnot. And the politicians write the rules to make it hard. I think campaign finance limits are basically incumbent protection. This has nothing to do with cleaning up politics. It has everything to do with protecting incumbents from potentially well-funded challengers, multimillionaire. It's always struck me, if you're a multimillionaire, the best thing would be if you could hand money to a good candidate. If you're kind of a nut yourself, you don't have to run, which is the only way you can do it now, but you could stand and have a press conference and give money to the person who's good and say, I've just given him $20 million, the world knows, whatnot. But it's hard because, you run for politics, you lose a lot of things. Market-oriented people very often want to make money in the market and they don't want to get stuck, in the political system.
I want to take a look at that term limit contradiction. A lot of cases today, one of the few people supporting liberty right now is Ron Paul. If you have term limits, his message would have never gotten done. So, what do you respond to those who say term limits hurt?
The question is, would term limits hurt causal liberty? What I would say is that there always are going to be good individuals who, in fact, I'd love to keep around. But I'm trying to change the system and the set of incentives. And the vast majority of permanent politicians are bad. And I think the evidence is overwhelming. The longer you stay in office, the more you spend. The more you're kind of tied to interest groups and the harder it is to get rid of you. And the less open seats you have, the less likely you are to have an election on issues. It becomes an election on, I got you your Social Security check. It's not an issue in terms of how do we fix Social Security. So you're absolutely right. There are individual cases like Ron Paul that I would hate to lose. But I would argue that overall, a system where there's a lot more churning, we would, in the end, be better off, even though, I would love to see him go run for something else, get elected to something else. I would hate losing him. I would accept that if I got change. If I didn't have Charlie Rangel around, and I didn't have, you know, fill in the blank, Nancy Pelosi, and, you know, get down the list.